further afield in search of sin and its remedies.
The Sunday feature begins a new three-part series tonight at 7:45 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. Very good afternoon from me, John Shea, with you this Sunday. In a couple of minutes, music for connoisseurs in the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping, and then at 2 o'clock, our Sunday concert captures the sights and sounds of the Mediterranean in a concert recorded last night at the Royal Festival Hall as part of the Rest is Noise Festival. Music by Respighi, Manuel de Falla and Ravel. That's in an hour from now at 2 o'clock. So now it's just after 1 o'clock and time for the latest BBC News. The Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has said the government's proposed changes to long-term social care in England will present a fully funded solution to the problem of rising costs. He says he wants to avoid the scandal of people having to sell their homes to pay for their care. It's understood Mr Hunt will confirm tomorrow that elderly people will have to pay no more than £75,000, excluding the costs of food and accommodation. A means test will be introduced so more people can get help, with the policy being paid for by changes to inheritance tax and the abolition of the state second pension. Six major French food retailers are withdrawing products made by Findus and Comigel because of the scare about horse meat, which had been labelled as beef. Here, the chairman of the Environment Select Committee, the Conservative MP Anne McIntosh, has called for a temporary ban on processed meat imports from the EU until the source of the contamination is identified. The Environment Secretary, Owen Paterson, said he would consider a ban only if evidence was found that the meat was dangerous. The Secular Party of Tunisia's president has resigned from the country's Islamist-led government, which has been in turmoil since the assassination last week of the opposition leader Shoukry Belaid. The authorities say one policeman has been killed and 59 others have been injured in violence since the murder. A new commander has taken charge of NATO forces in Afghanistan. The US Marine General Joseph Dunford was installed at a ceremony at the Alliance's headquarters outside Kabul. He'll be responsible for overseeing the withdrawal from Afghanistan of international troops. A four-week-old boy is recovering after being attacked by a fox at his home in Bromley in southeast London. The boy suffered injuries to his hand, and surgeons at St Thomas's Hospital are reported to have reattached a finger. The Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, has called on local councils to take action against urban foxes. And the weather. There'll be rain and snow across large parts of the UK. Some drier and clearer spells will develop in places this evening, especially across northern England. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 3 minutes past one. So, now it's time for today's Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. I would suggest that even to today's ears, that music sounds pretty unconventional. The harmonies move in a strange way. Just when you feel you can predict how a phrase is going to end or resolve, in comes an unexpected chord, a strange turn, if you like, almost disconcerting, that takes the voices off in quite a new direction. The performers there were the Brabant Ensemble, directed by Stephen Rice. And it's actually the prologue to a much longer work, Prophetae Sibillarum, written probably in the early 1570s by the Franco-Flemish composer Orlando de Lassus, a man who wasn't only the most prolific composer of his age, but also the most celebrated. In fact, in 1573, the King of France, Charles IX, was said to have been so ravished by that work's extraordinary sounds and textures that he offered Lassus a large sum of money to enter his service. Lassus, by the way, declined, preferring to remain in the service of the Duke of Bavaria. "I do not want to leave my house, my garden and other good things in Munich," he wrote. Whether or not he knew it, what the French king had recognised was one of the finest examples of something that's been described in the pages of musical history as musica reservata. And here we open something of a can of worms. There are several historical references to composers writing in the reservata style in the late 1500s, but frustratingly, there's no real definition, so the term remains controversial and imprecise. All we can do more than 400 years on to find a meaning is to piece together various clues. One theory is that musica reservata was intended exclusively for the cognoscenti, literally music reserved for those in the know. Another is that it was particularly chromatic, involving new kinds of rhythms and sometimes featuring a soloist, perhaps one reserved for special occasions. But the main thing about musica reservata seems to have been that it was highly expressive, descriptive and affecting, prompted perhaps by the fashionable intellectual humanist philosophy of the period. Another composer of the late Renaissance who's associated with the term is Philippe de Monte. His setting of the Miserere Mei Deus contains the sort of dissonances that were being explored by the movement, particularly in penitential texts like the one we're going to hear now, where expressive dissonances and the gradual unfolding of the lines change the mood little by little.
Thank you.
Miserere Mei, a setting from the second half of the 1500s by Philip de Monte. The singers there were Cinquecento. So, the term musica reservata suggests a way of using the music to help bring out the meaning of the text. Seems pretty obvious to us nowadays, of course, that some sad lyric should be set in a minor key or to a slow melody, or that a cheerful lyric should have an upbeat tune or a bouncy rhythm to match. But in earlier times, in the church music tradition, expressing words through the music simply wasn't how composers thought. The music was seen as an entity in itself, something that ran concurrently with the text. So the idea of shaping music to evoke a sentiment was a very progressive idea, and one that seems to have been an important ingredient in musica reservata. What's more, these affects could be extremely powerful. Orlando de Lassus was widely regarded as the most important composer of his day, more famous even than his contemporary Palestrina. And in his set of penitential Psalms of David, he created not only a masterpiece of colour and variety, but one in which music and text work hand in hand to give expression to the meaning of the words. All this prompted one humanist writer to ponder, one might wonder whether it is the emotions which adorn the melodies or the melodies which adorn the emotions. We'll hear the first of Lassus's psalms now. Domine, ne in furore tuo arguas me. Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger.
Oh. Thank you.
the first of the penitential Psalms of David by Orlando de Lassus from the second half of the 16th century. Collegium Vocale Ghent, directed by Philippe Erevecker. When Lassus's employer, Maximilian of Bavaria, heard those psalms, he was so impressed that he took the extraordinary step of having the complete set lavishly bound and illustrated, and they remain to this day one of the most expensive artistic collections ever created. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're looking at Musica Reservata. Certainly an important factor in all this was the interest in the ancient world, in particular the perceived ideas about how ancient music may have sounded. The late 16th century thinkers began to seriously research and hypothesise about ancient Greek music, drama and poetry. They began to experiment and think again about the rules that governed harmony and the relationship between different musical notes. At the forefront of this was a radical musician from Ferrara, Nicola Vicentino. His ideas about harmony and tuning resulted in some highly novel effects, shifts of sonority and attempts at word painting that are pretty amazing in any age, as we're going to hear now in this setting of words by the doyen of humanist literature, Dante. The breeze stirs the laurel with a little sigh, and here the music seems to sigh as well. And Laura's golden hair makes souls to wander from their bodies. Oh, hear this prayer, great Jove. Here Vicentino pulls out all the stops. I pray my end before hers so that I may not see the world left without its sun. The Wellgus Ensemble, directed by Paul van Nevel, with Laura Celverde Lauro, a sonnet by the medieval poet Petrarch, set to music some 200 years later by Nicola Vicentino. It's highly likely that Lassus, whose music we heard earlier, knew about Vicentino's modern theories of harmony and tuning, and that Lassus's celebrated Prophetiae Sibyllarum, the visions of the Sibyls, was a response to them. The image of the ancient Sibyls with their ability to foresee the future was one that appealed enormously in the late Renaissance, with one foot in the ancient world and another within the body of the church. In Rome, Lassus may well have seen the Sibyls painted by Raphael in the church of Santa Maria della Pace, as well as those of Michelangelo on the Sistine Chapel ceiling. There had originally just been one Sibyl. Hierophile of Erythrae is thought to have been a real visionary from the 8th century BC. However, when Herodotus mentioned her in his writings a few centuries later, the Sibyls had become three. And by the time the church had got its hands on the story and changed it to reflect the Christian message and the cleansing of all sins, well, the three Sibyls eventually became 12, appearing at the 12 Christian altars across the known world, where they recounted their visions of the Christ to come. It's this Christian interpretation that Lassus set to music. Each of the 12 Sibyls is given a different character, and Lassus creates further variety by dividing the pieces into pairs and setting the words in different ranges of pitch. But the most striking thing about the Prophetiae is Lassus's use of harmony, which suggests his interest in the theories and methods of ancient music. Its dissonant style makes for a highly expressive work, and one known to have been greatly marvelled at by the cognoscenti in the 16th century. So to end, we're going to hear a complete performance of the Prophetiae, and it's one that seems to capture the intimate nature of the music. This is Cantus Köln, with Konrad Junghänel directing from the lute.
Oh. Oh,
the Prophetiae Sibyllarum of Orlando de Lassus, performed there by Cantus Köln with Konrad Junghänel, directing from the lute. One of the finest examples of a harmonically rich and intellectually challenging form of Renaissance music, referred to as musica reservata, which has been the subject of today's Early Music Show. I hope you'll join me again.
That was Lucy Skeeping, and today's Early Music Show was produced in Salford by Chris Wines. Now, just before our Sunday concert, Martin Handley previews Tuesday evening's offering.
She performed it in Istanbul, now she brings it to London. On BBC Radio 3, the culmination of a European tour, Janine Jansen performs Mozart's Turkish Violin Concerto No. 5 in Radio 3, live in concert. Alongside it, more Mozart, the Concerto No. 2, and Mozart's very first symphony. Radio 3, live in concert from London's Cadogan Hall, Tuesday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Where it's now 2:02 and time for the Sunday concert. This was recorded last night at the Royal Festival Hall in London. It's introduced by Patrick Trelawney.
Welcome to the Royal Festival Hall, where the London Philharmonic Orchestra are here on stage for a concert that is part of the South Bank Centre and LPO's groundbreaking celebration of 20th century music, The Rest is Noise. In this concert, music written over 15 years in the first two decades of the century. Maria Luigia Borsi sings Respighi's Il Tramonto, and Javier Perianis plays the piano in Falla's Nights in the Gardens of Spain. And we stay in Spain for Ravel's Rhapsody Espagnole. Well, the conductor today is an Italian who is music director of one of France's leading orchestras. Please welcome Enrique Mazzola. Enrique, the unifying theme of this concert would seem to be a sense of place. We have the fountains of Rome, we have those nights in the gardens of Spain, we have Shelley painting a wonderfully evocative sunset. Is this music that is descriptive and formally programmatic, or is there something much more evocative and poetic about it?
Well, I would say both, yes. They have some program. They are looking for a description of the situation. Very nice. In Fontane di Roma, we have in 18 minutes, 24 hours, because this is very typical of Italian, yes, to do something very, very fast. Well, what you can do, yes, in 18 minutes is better. And, you know, it starts with a very early morning and it finishes with a very late night. Of course, through the description of the different fountains, there is a lot of, I use your word, evocative, yes? There is a, so not exactly telling you what happens in the fountain, but just let you imagine perfumes, situations. I think you should close eyes and feel it through the music.
It's really interesting that three of the works tonight were written during the First World War. Do you think there was a conscious decision by these southern European composers to look away and create something new that was different to the formality of Austro-German music that had gone before?
Yes, you know, I'm Italian, so I have to say that, for example, Respighi, yes, he wanted to free himself from the German tradition and to build a new, let's say, Italian way to do the symphonic music. And I think that he was completely successful. He had, of course, important influences. He studied with Rimsky-Korsakov in St. Petersburg. And you will hear a lot of Debussy, for example, Stravinsky in Fontane di Roma. He was living his period, but he was very convinced that there was an Italian way to compose the symphonic music.
Well, let us hear the Fountains of Rome. Ladies and gentlemen, Enrique Mazzola and the London Philharmonic Orchestra.